Graham Harper's sound and director's vision, quite literally providing a whole new audio perspective on the craft of the moving image. And if you don't understand what that means, let me just tell you, Graham Harper's awesome.
Ascenseur pour l'échafaud. No, certainly my French isn't probably up to spec, but Elevator to the Gallows, or possibly Lifts to the Scaffold, a film directed by Louis Malle, starring Jean Moreau and Maurice Sarrone as illicit lovers whose murder plot starts to unravel because of a malfunctioning elevator. Interesting, we're going back in time. We're going back to 1958 for this, yes. As we actually welcome to his own show, of course, Graham Harper, Graham's sound and director's vision. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I hope you are.
Indeed. So, back to 1958, after all our progressing move forwards over recent weeks, here we are, episode 6, and you're taking us into a jazz zone.
Yes, it's because I listened to jazz from quite a very early age. I was probably 14, I think, 13 or 14. Not in 1958, I was only about 12 then. But I discovered jazz through a friend of mine at school, Eugene Ankeny, his name was. And he was brought up in a jazz world, as it were. And he introduced me to jazz. This film, Lift to the Scaffold, was a film I saw probably not in 58, but I was too young probably to see that. But maybe when I was 16 or 17, I remember going to the cinema to see this film, which was a very sad story, starring Jean Moreau and a fabulous French actor called Leo Ventura, who played a detective investigating a murder of which Jean Moreau was the culprit, as well, one of them. It's a very sad film, very emotional film, and it struck me because the film sort of was voiced by her. So she was talking to camera most of the time. And then we obviously would cut to various aspects of the story as it unfolded. It was beautifully directed, a new wave French film. I think it was the first one that Louis Malle made. And it was a brilliant story, a very sad story, with a fantastic jazz score. And I think it was, I think when I read up about it, it was most improvised by Miles Davis. And I have the feeling it was his first venture into film scores. It's so evocative and such a fabulous opening track to start the film. And then there's Miles Davis all the way through the movie. It's a really interesting use of jazz, and very emotional, very evocative of both the period and of the film and the story. And is still modern to this day. This could be a piece of music that was written yesterday and is fabulous. It's a fabulous score. I use that word a lot, fabulous, but it really is exciting. And if you didn't like jazz beforehand or didn't know much about jazz, this is not a bad one to listen to start with.
It's been associated by many critics with the film noir style and introduced new narrative and editing techniques. Are these things which have consciously impacted on your own work when you look back over this particular interesting movie, which again is as you say, carved its opening in terms of filmic history? Are there any moments where you've sort of thought, yeah, I wanted to actually get that kind of feel into my particular productions?
It must have rubbed off a lot of the films like Truffaut movies, etc. They were French films, especially the New Wave. There's a quality of those films that's still there with French movies now, which is the soundtracks, not just the music, but the actual atmosphere created by the soundtrack is very lively, modern. You feel you're really in the cafes, listening, having your conversations, or you're being part of the conversation of the film, but not hearing the other dialogue, but very aware there are many people around and the coffee espresso machines are sounding behind the bar. It's they're very, very lively and play a main feature in the films. And I think before that, the films were very classically made and very stylish. The New Wave was very stylish, but very modern. And it loved its soundtrack, its actual sound background. Mm-hmm. So from sound point of view, yes, I think we try to do that now in television, for example. But what's really interesting is the style of shooting, the detail, the fast editing, fast cutting. It doesn't get in the way, and yet you're very aware of the editing, if that makes sense, because the editing of most of these films is very important. Well, obviously, it's important in any film, but very important. It plays a major role. It's very distinctive, and you can understand why editors would win awards, Oscars, for the editing. It's very noticeable in this film, the detail of the cutaways, the strange angles that Louis Malle uses, which are now not strange anymore, is what we do, but they were very new and very stylish in a very modern way. So yes, it was the fast editing and fast cutting that I quite liked that I think has stuck with me. So there's a kind of energy, there's a pace, even though the story unfolds gently, there's quite an energy to it.
And also, presumably, as you've said, a French film with subtitles and so on, or was your French sufficiently okay to say, don't bother me with the subtitles, I can watch it in its original, authentic French?
Oh, no. No, I don't speak French very well. I understand it now because I'm married to a French lady, but I understand French a lot. I'm not sure I'm very, very, very good at French, but I certainly wasn't then. So I had to kind of watch the subtitles. But you do, and you don't miss anything. And also good films you go and see again anyway. So you kind of know the story by the time you see the second time, and you can really watch the visuals. ¶¶
we're staying in 1958 for your next choice, because that also was the basis of the Robert Wise directed film I Want to Live. Robert Wise, of course, I know from The Day the Earth Stood Still, from West Side Story, from The Sound of Music, and of course Star Trek the Motion Picture and the Andromeda Strain. So he also had worked with Citizen Kane. But this one, a biographical film noir. So we're still in terms of film noir, or one which actually apparently had a total of 6 Academy Award nominations. Susan Hayward won Best Actress Oscar at the 31st Academy Award, as well as a Golden Globe. And a very hard-hitting line, which maybe people don't expect when they look back at the cinema of the 1950s, and particularly American cinema, because it follows the life of prostitute Barbara Graham, an habitual criminal who's convicted of murder and faces capital punishment. I presume you weren't seeing this as a young child, Graham?
No. No, again, I tend to watch... I love watching classic films on television. That's not the way I love to watch films, but the only time, unless some art houses have a retrospective season of old movies, you have to watch them. You know, most of these films come up sometime in the year on the various TV channels. So this one, I Want to Live, I didn't see it in 1958, but I saw it several years later, I think probably at an art house cinema. Again, this film is very similar in story to Live to the Scaffold. Both films were about women who faced the death penalty, basically, because their involvement with a murder of some sort. This is a terrific film again, very evocative in its use of the music again. So Robert Wise chose a jazz musician and a jazz score for his film. Johnny Mandel created, he was the composer. And Jerry Mulligan, I think Quintet, played most of the music. Again, I loved Jerry Mulligan. I heard him when I was 13 and 14. He was one of the musicians that I was made aware of by my friend Eugene. And I love the baritone saxophone, the way Jerry Mulligan uses it. The saxophone and the use of saxophone is very much like a voice, a human voice. And I think it's used a lot. I think most people who like jazz, we like all the instruments, but when a saxophone player starts to play and improvise, you are hearing his voice inside, or his interpretation in this case, of the mood and atmosphere of the film. And it was a very good choice. His use of the saxophone and his use and interpretation of the music is, again, fabulous. It's very evocative. It takes you right to the heart of the various characters or the scene. A lot of television programmes, I'm talking about television because I've never made a film, but a lot of television programmes use music as background, sometimes, occasionally, wrongly. Some things don't need any music. The story itself can tell its own atmosphere and feeling and emotion. But sometimes you really need and want the deeper thoughts of the person, which could be interpreted by, in this case, the saxophone. And that use is brilliant. And when a composer writes something to suit a scene, to give the audience the added secret emotions or thoughts that person may have, is really, really interesting. And I think this is a great film to watch. And also be aware of the music and what it's doing for the story. Is it getting in the way? Is it really helping you to understand the emotions and the plot? Or is it getting in the way? I mean, most times you go to see a film, we'll come to talk about action later, but music can help action. It can help the edits, the fast pace and whatever. But also sometimes you don't need music at all. The action itself can just drive the story. Here in these two films, Lift to the Scaffold and I Want to Live, I think the use of jazz, perhaps just saying jazz is silly, because I think jazz, the name jazz, can put some people off. It shouldn't, because jazz is like, it encompasses all kind of styles, you know, classical, rock, pop, or chamber music. I'm thinking like the modern jazz quartet. That's like chamber music, but of the 70s and 80s. I mean, very modern, and yet it's not. If you say jazz, well, that's not the first thing you think of, the modern jazz quartet for jazz, and yet it's still jazz. Very emotive again, and very, very deep and serious with some humour and whatever. This use of jazz and these instruments in these two films is absolutely perfect. And I want everyone to, if you ever get a chance to see them, don't miss them. Don't think, oh, it's a boring French film. No, it's not. Very exciting. Louis Malle using Miles Davis. Fabulous, clever idea. Again, in the second film, I Want to Live, Robert Wise's use of jazz again with Jerry Mulligan, absolutely right on. One of the stars of the film.
In the heat of the night, seems like a cold sweat creeping across my brow. Yeah, in the heat of night, I'm feeling motherless. Stars with evil eyes stare from the skies, all mean and bright.
In the heat of the night,
ain't a woman yet been born. Knows how to make the morn call. It's so hard to keep control when I had to sell my soul for just a little light.
In the heat of the night,
in the heat of the night, I've got trouble wall to wall. Oh, yes, I have. I repeat in the night. Must be an ending to it all. But hold on. Just you be strong, and it'll be all right.
In the heat of the night.
In the heat of the night.
You're listening to Graham Harper's Sound and Director's Vision on Siren Radio and Southside Broadcasting. And now we actually move to another interesting line, because when the American Film Institute effectively came up with 100 movie quotes for 100 years of cinema, in at number 16 was, "They call me Mr. Tibbs." That line, they got a murder on their hands, they don't know what to do with it. It's not so much the film, although inevitably we're going to talk about that. But In the Heat of the Night, with Ray Charles performing and a Quincy Jones score. We're in the heart of the 60s here, 1967, of course, with the Norman Jewison directed In the Heat of the Night.
Oh, the moment you hear this music, so when the credits start or the opening title starts, when you hear this music, you don't know the story, you don't know what you're going to see. But boy, you know it's going to be Deep South. It's going to be racism. It's going to be interesting. It's going to be good. It's going to have fantastic performance. And guess what? They are. It starts off, obviously, with this fabulous piece of music sung by Ray Charles. And Ray Charles sings and plays all kinds of genre of jazz, but in this one, the music is just wonderful. And all the way through the film, it's not all Ray Charles all the way through the film, but the use of music in this film is stunning for different reasons, because it's very evocative and changes all the time. But the opening title music is, you just sit back in the cinema and just go, yes, I want this film to run all over me. I want to be absorbed, or I want to absorb myself into the story. It's just a lovely clarion call to a great story, and played beautifully by Sidney Poitier and Rod Steiger. Rod Steiger is a racist chief of police, having to put up with and having to agree to work alongside this black detective from Pennsylvania. He doesn't want to know. He doesn't want this person coming into his territory, telling him what to do and how to go about whatever. But he happens to be a superb and clever detective, police detective. He shows Rod Steiger's character a thing or two, and it unfolds beautifully, the story. It's a very interesting mystery that unfolds. And I can't say the two of them love each other at the end of the film, but they both learn something about each other. It's a great story, and the music just makes you want to watch it.
Selected for preservation in the United States National Film Registry by the Library of Congress in 2002, a film being classified as being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. We'll move on to the action-adventure world of Steve McQueen. Certainly, you could say a definition of masculinity, together with Robert Vaughn, of course, in this particular aspect. And, of course, somebody who went on to do, amongst other things, the theme music to Starsky and Hutch, a classic well worth watching after House of Elliot on a Saturday evening, I think. Or maybe not. But in addition to that, of course, we have the joys of Lalo Schifrin, of course. And here we're going to listen to the Bullet theme. action and adventure, or as you like to say, Graham, when you're on the set, action, action, action. Or indeed, you know, other things might sort of develop on that basis. So was this a movie which you thought, excellent, this is ultimately the classic way in which action adventure can be portrayed on the big screen, with, of course, probably, or indeed arguably, the premiere of car chase sequences?
Wow. So Bullet, Steve McQueen was one of my great heroes. I loved this actor. He was my hero. I just thought, and Clint Eastwood, my second, and he's still my second. Bullet came along. We read all about it. So we all wanted to go and see it. It had Steve McQueen, who was box office, big time box office. And this film, I think most of the critics talked about the car chase. So everybody wanted to go see this film, obviously because it was going to be a thriller of a police story. But secondly, we all wanted to see this. What was all this talk about this car chase? Well, so you've got the Bullet theme, which is brilliant to get you started. And then great score of music all the way through the film. And what's brilliant about it, I talked before about sometimes there's music when you don't need music. Well, here's a classic example of how music is used, the lead up to the car chase. So there's a moment in the film where Steve McQueen walks across the street to get into his car. He's aware that there are a couple of people in a car watching him. He's very aware. You don't know totally that he's aware, but you've got the, he sussed something. Anyway, he gets into his car. So the moment he starts walking across the street to get in the car, there's this jazz score starts. Lala Schifrin is giving us this mysterious and quite tense kind of music. So you know something's going to happen. He gets into the car. He starts to drive. As he starts to drive, he looks into his mirror and he sees, sure enough, a car suddenly appears amongst the traffic in the background, following him, seems to be following him. So there's a kind of gentle, it's not fast, it's gentle cat and mouse with this tense jazz score, orchestral jazz score going. And it's driving the scene. It's driving, because not lots happening. It's just cat and mouse, car driving, getting lost and behind other cars, the other car trying to keep up, etc. And Steve McQueen doesn't seem to be able to lose them. What are they doing? Who are these people? And you keep having cutaways of the two strange, thuggish men in this car following him. And both cars, you can tell just by the look of the cars, they are fast and they're powerful. They are stars in their own right in this sequence. Suddenly, the two guys, you see Steve McQueen's car from their point of view, and then suddenly it's disappeared. The two guys are looking, going, what's going on? Where's he gone? And they're looking to all the streets as they go past the streets. He must have turned off somewhere. And as they're driving along, Steve McQueen is no longer in front of them. And then suddenly they look in the mirror and he's behind them. And now the film takes on a different style. Now it's Steve McQueen is following them. And the music ups the tempo and starts to get a little bit faster and a little bit more aggressive and more cat and mouse-ish. And it goes on for maybe 4 or 5 minutes, this with this music driving the scene. It's brilliant. And then suddenly, just when you're not expecting, you're wondering what's going to happen, the two men in their car, the thugs, suddenly roar away and bend sharp left, take a turning and take off. Steve McQueen changes gear and off again. And the music stops abruptly, and the car, or the cars and their engines and their gear changes and the burning of rubber and the squealing of the tyres, that takes over the soundtrack. No more music. And for 4 or 5 minutes, there's this extraordinary car chase through the streets of San Francisco with wonderful camera work. Long lens shots on fast action. Now that is really hard to do if you're on a long lens trying to capture in focus fast action that is really, really tricky. I don't know how many cameramen they had on the sequence, but they must have had 5 or 6 on the different setups to try and capture this, the pace and energy. It is visually stunning. And from that moment onwards, I'm not going to tell you what happens, because if those who haven't seen it, they must see it. It's just marvellous. What's wonderful about it is it's a 10-minute sequence, the car chase. For the first 3 or 4 or 5 minutes, there's music. And it's really, really exciting, because you're left, your emotions are left in, not in, well, they're left in tatters at the end, but you have to fill in the thoughts for everybody. Music-wise, that's helping you, but you have to fill in what's going on, etc. And the music's driving you. And then suddenly it stops and there's no more music. The actual atmospheric soundtrack drives the whole thing from there onwards, and it's brilliant. And actually, from that moment onwards, every car chase that's made from that date onwards had to up its game. There's no, and of course, many people couldn't afford to do it, so I suppose they had to abandon the idea, because to do what they did in that film, Peter Yates' idea of how to do that with Steve McQueen and his stunt coordinators was just brilliant. Peter Yates got that film. Steve McQueen, his company, made the film, and Steve McQueen's choice was Peter Yates. And he got that film from because of the film Robbery, which I believe was because of the way he handled car chases and whatever in that film. That's why Steve McQueen went for this British director. And I think it made Peter Yates in America. I mean, from that moment onwards, he could do no wrong.
Well, interesting. Of course, he had a background in television before then, because he directed 7 episodes of the Roger Moore Saints television series, and also 7 episodes of Patrick McGowan, much known for his calm and general sort of overall sort of peaceful approach to life. Not in Danger Man. We were talking on another show, Resonance Rewind, and still are talking about The Prisoner, and of course the controversy over that. But the only 2 episodes of Danger Man that were made in colour, Karoshi and Shinda Shima, were both directed by Peter Yates. So again, a way in which the similarities between television and certainly the spy drama or the adventure drama series leading on to Robbery and Bullet. It's fair to say, probably not many people would say Mother Jugs and Speed was one of his greatest, but obviously The Friends of Eddie Coyle, For Pete's Sake. Krull, of course, was also a Peter Yates movie. So an interesting career on the back of a car chase.
Yes, absolutely. It's funny because I also read he didn't want to get typecast into all these action kind of films. So he took on a variety of different sorts of films and obviously television programmes. But he, for me, he was known for big and classic, stunning style of shooting. Very modern, very pacey, very energetic director, really exciting.
To the 70s with the original term Shaft. And of course, again, the Lalo Schifrin, or rather the Isaac Hayes, I should say, interpretation of this particular classic. Again, fan of Richard Roundtree, did you feel that this opened up a whole range of things, or is it a case of who's the man who calls the score? It's Harper. Harper, Graham.
Well, you talked about the black movement, if you like, not only just the black movement, but the use and the moment black actors really started to take lead roles. Well, of course, they did. We had Harry Belafonte. We've obviously had Sidney Poitier, both terrific actors. Sammy Davis Jr., I'm thinking of in Porgy and Bess and various films he was in. Again, a terrific actor. There was definitely room and still is room for black actors. That's without a doubt. Shaft, I think, was brilliant. I don't know that it was a brilliant film compared to the likes of Bullet. But it was notable because it had Gordon Parks was a black cameraman and eventually film director. I think this was his first major film. So it's not bad for a first film. It's just by comparison to other great detective thrillers or action pieces, it's probably not the best. But it's certainly not the worst. It's a terrific story. And Richard Roundtree, I think, is wonderful in this. Great, Mr. Cool, like Steve McQueen. This guy is cool. This film is cool. The music is cool. Isaac Hayes. Now, a lot of people would think probably Isaac Hayes isn't jazz. He's more kind of disco, I suppose, people might think. Wrong. Definitely a jazz musician. Great score for this film. With a great song, it was cool, and that's all I can say about it. Really, this. If you want to see a cool film, this is cool. It's great to watch. When you come out of the cinema, you have seen something smashing. Yes, you could see probably something better, maybe better told. I don't know. It is smashing, and it's led by a terrific actor. The score is brilliant.
And of course, it did actually win a Grammy Award for the best original score written for a motion picture back in 1971.
Excellent.
We're coming to the end of this particular edition of Sound and Director's Vision, Graham Harper's Sound and Director's Vision. And I won't say anything about butter or anything else in this particular case because it's highly unfortunate and probably in very poor taste, particularly when margarine might have served just as well. But Last Tango in Paris. Controversial movie at the time, controversial movie now because of obviously Maria Schneider's concerns about how she felt exploited with Marlon Brando at the time. But you've gone for the music for this. So, we'll probably talk about this once again in the next episode. But why are we actually wrapping up with this sequence from Last Tango in Paris?
I think it's because it's Latin American jazz, if you like, by Gatto Barbieri. I think the film score, the jazz, his particular opening title music is terrific on this film. The subject matter, I'm not sure, it was quite an odd film when I saw it. Again, I was quite young when I saw this film. I haven't seen it in a long time. I remember Marlon Brando giving a terrific performance in it. I remember Maria Schneider being brilliant. And it was Bernardo Bertolucci. So it was a film he had to go and see. I think it was probably his first film, wasn't it, Bernardo Bertolucci's? But he's made some great movies. 1900, if you've ever seen that, it's two parts of the film. That's brilliant. He really had grown by then, become this marvellous director. He wasn't bad in this. It's a strange story. It's quite disturbing. The end is very disturbing. Well, not the end, but towards the end, it gets very disturbing, particularly about the area that Maria Schneider's talking about. So it's still a film you have to see. It's like Kubrick's film.
Lola.
No,
Eyes Wide Shut.
No.
2001 Space Odyssey.
No, even earlier than that.
Even earlier than that?
Yeah, I'll come back to it.
Dr. Strangelove.
Nope. They're all great movies.
Lolita.
Nope. Let's move on. Because it's gone out of my brain, but it will come back. What's lovely about this film is the opening title theme. Again, it's got lovely use of music through it. Parisian music and jazz. But the opening title is, again, fabulous use of saxophone. It's Latin American, but also if you listen to it, you can hear a bit of France, a bit of Paris in it. It's a lovely musical score. This kind of misleading because although it's mysterious, it's beautiful. And then this story, I couldn't say this story is beautiful. It's interesting. It is romantic, but there's a very hard, nasty edge to the whole film. And the music doesn't really tell you that story right at the beginning. It's quite misleading, but still a great score.